nonsense. As live as they want to be from California, here's Sean and Jen.
I got 99 microphone problems and a not microphone problem ain't one.
Yeah, that worked. Oh, well.
We sort of do everything on the fly over here.
Oh, pretty much, yeah.
Just in case you didn't realize that already. Welcome to Hyper Nonsense, the other podcast that comes to you straight from the heart of California, a.k.a. the Golden State, a.k.a. where we be living. How are you doing tonight, Jen?
I'm okay.
We were doing a little bit of audio troubleshooting in the pre-show portion of tonight's recording sesh.
Yep.
Is it better to say sesh? I feel like it's more efficient.
I don't know.
I believe it's
one of those weird abbreviations that you might use if you were texting or trying to fit it into something on Twitter where you had a limited amount of, you know, characters.
I believe it just
sounds weird when you say it out loud.
We're just having a sesh. We're just down here at the studio having a sesh.
See, it just sounds pretentious.
I believe in the, as I like to call it, the Max F lifestyle for maximum efficiency, so I kind of feel like sesh.
Well, considering things lately, I don't know that we're doing so good on that one.
Wait. What do you mean?
Oh, we'll get there.
Well, yeah. So it's been a little while since we put out our last program, and by that I think it's really only been a week.
So that's not bad. Yeah, a week or so is not bad.
So well done to us. We're sticking to it. Our New Year's res to put shows out. We're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the year of Hyper Nonsense 2015.
Okay.
Get ready.
Because as it stands, it looks like we're going to have plenty of free time to do that in. So, yeah.
What does that mean?
Well.
All right. Well, let's just get into things. So, the first thing I guess that's worth mentioning is I had kind of said on the last show, or maybe the one before, that I was closer, it seemed, to being employed than I have been since, December of 2013, since that's really the last time I was employed. So to give a little more of the backstory here, in my continued effort to try and find a job, I reached out to a company that I actually used to work for in Illinois. Now, they are a call center, very similar in scope to the one that I worked for here in California. And I knew that they had at least one employee that had worked from home. Now, that employee was also in Illinois, and I really didn't know where they were at with the whole thing. But I figured I got nothing to lose. I sent him an email, figuring I would either get a polite thanks but no thanks back, or I just wouldn't get a response at all. Not because they're a bad company, but because just I didn't really think that they would look at this whole thing of me working there from California to really be an equitable thing, which is totally understandable. But we engaged in a dialogue, and emails were sent, and documents were sent, and phone calls were made. And it looked like it was going to be a real thing. Well, last week, I did a little bit of training, and I actually took some calls. And something happened that was really unexpected. Now, as I suspect anyone who's heard this podcast before knows, I am legally blind. And because of that, there's a lot of limitations I have to deal with, and even when it comes to using computers, you know, there's still problems. So the way that I have to work with this company is I connect over remote desktop to a computer in their office. And from there, I effectively work as though I'm actually on site. I thought I would actually need to run Windows, which is why I mentioned that whole project I went through with boot camp and Parallels and all that. And as it turns out, I only needed to use a remote desktop client on my Mac. I didn't actually need to launch Windows. So that was handy because it's just easier to manage. But more importantly, I didn't have to pay the licensing fee to Parallels because I'm not actually running Windows. I'm just running remote desktop. So no problem. And, you know, the technology, everything worked all right. Better than, honestly, I thought it would. Because when I worked for the similar company here in California, the setup was a little different. I didn't actually do a remote desktop thing. I did something else. But so far, technically speaking, for the most part, it's working okay. And I trained for a couple hours. I needed, obviously, a lot less training than a brand new person at this work because I've done it for a long time.
Well, and you've done it with that company.
Well, and I worked for this
specifically with company that company
before.
As well.
Now, it's been 13 years, but I have worked for them before, so I knew some of the basic kind of ins and outs of things. And the software, these particular types of companies all use the same program. It's a proprietary program made by one vendor, and they all of them use it. I've worked for three of these different companies over the last 20 years. They all use the same software. So I had to kind of get adjusted to how they have it set up because different places set keys up differently. But for the most part, we're talking about a lot of the same things. And I worked for a few hours Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of last week. And for the entire time, I had non-stop severe eye strain starting from Tuesday afternoon pretty much up until Friday night. Now that is not entirely normal. When I worked for the same type of company here in California, I was working from home. I was using the same computer, essentially the same software. And, you know, after a typical shift, which, you know, I worked part-time, so generally 4 to 5 hours a shift, somewhere in there, I would come away from the computer with, you know, a decent level of eye strain. And then I would have to just sort of go away from the computer for a while, not do anything really eye intensive. You know, I couldn't read or, you know, I just had to do things that didn't require a lot of focus from my eyes. And generally after 5 or 6 hours, my eyes would kind of rest. They'd go back to mostly normal and I could go back to the computer and do other things or read or whatever. Well, for whatever reason, this time around, it was way worse. And I haven't entirely worked out why that is. I have noticed that, you know, over the last year or so, and it's been, you know, 13, 14 months since I've done this kind of work, I have noticed that my vision has degraded a bit. Not a dramatic amount, but I'm noticing more and more that it's getting harder for me to read things that are in print, just like regular, you know, 12-point font in books and stuff like that. So if I'm reading a book for myself, I'll use a magnifying glass. You know, if I just need to look at something real quick, usually what I do, and I really can't see it well enough, I'll take a picture of it with my iPad and then I'll just zoom in with the photo app and it'll, you know, enlarge it so I can see it. Well, this software that I have to use is not very pretty. It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles as far as the way that you can change it or, you know, make it bigger, better, easier to read, whatever you want to say. And obviously, like everything in the world, as it should be, is not designed for a visually impaired person. So on Friday, after, you know, 3 days of this intense eye strain, I wasn't scheduled to work Friday over the weekend because I'm still in training. And on Friday afternoon, I kind of said, you know what, I if this is what I have to look forward to, I can't live like this. It's impossible. I mean, I can't be in a constant strain, a constant state of more or less eye strain. Like, that's not how a human being can live. So I called him up and I said, I'm facing this problem. I'm not sure what to do, but I can't go on like this. And we kind of talked it out. And the decision we came to was, well, for me to go to an eye doctor, get checked out. I haven't been to one in over 10 years. Go to an eye doctor, get checked out, see if there's anything they can do. You know, there's not anything that any eye doctor can do that's going to make me walk out and have vision that's close to a normal person. But they might be, if I explain the problem, they might be able to give me some sort of eyeglass prescription with a little bit of magnification in it, you know, glare reduction. I don't know. I've been given prescription glasses in the past, and I usually never wore them a lot because the improvement was nominal. But whatever improvement I can get now, it might be enough to at least lessen the eye strain so I can go to work part-time at this job. Now, starting this year, I got new medical insurance, which, as it turns out, is an HMO. And I've never had an HMO before. And the way that HMOs work is everything sort of goes through your primary care doctor. Well, when I signed up for this plan, I told them to put down my doctor as the last doctor that I'd seen when I had insurance, which was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And, you know, they did. I got my insurance card. I figured, okay, I'm going to... And I called the insurance company and I said, just to clarify, before I can see an ophthalmologist, I've got to get authorization. They said, yeah. So I called my regular doctor and I said, hey, I'm back. I got insurance. Hallelujah. Praise the Lord. And they said, yeah, you know, we're really sorry, but because you haven't been here in so long, we kind of have to treat you as a new patient and we're not accepting new patients. I kind of went,
so that was the end of that. Yeah.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. So I called the insurance company back and explained to them the situation, and they had given me a booklet with all the primary care doctors that are in their network. And I said, well, I guess I just got to go to the mat here and start making phone calls. And I looked through the book because I have at least a base familiarity with a lot of the doctors that work out here because of my old job.
Which was an answering service that answered for some of the doctors.
Right.
Right.
So I started looking for familiar names, just kind of seeing if there was anybody there that I remember dealing with directly and thinking, oh, that person seems like a nice person. And I called what was my first choice, and they said, nope, no new patients. Sorry. So today, I just said, all right, I'm going to kind of go down this list and I'm going to start from who scares me the least upward. And the first office I called is actually the office that Jen used to go to.
Yeah, I was seeing not the doctor that's named on the office, but right. I think she was an RN?
Nurse practitioner.
Okay.
I think it was a nurse practitioner.
Something like that. And she was really cool. You know, I had no problem with her. But it turns out the doctor and another doctor there are on your list of potentials over
right.
there.
So I called there first, and they said, nope, no new patients. And they said, because of the kind of insurance you have, we can't assign you to a PA or a nurse practitioner. It'd have to be through an actual doctor.
Right.
So then again, I just started going down the list. Found one that said, we are accepting new patients, but we can't get you in for an appointment until April 20th.
Yep.
And I said,
that's how it goes when you're poor. Can't get into nothing.
And I said, well, I guess I better do that. And if I, you know, change things, I'll call you back. So I took the April 20th appointment. So that's like 13 weeks from now.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I, just for kind of good measure, I called another office after that. Now, I'm kind of happy in a way with the doctor that's willing to see me in April, just in the sense that I know who she is. I've talked to her. I believe not only that she's a good doctor, but she's you know, kind of a reasonable person. Because, you know, doctors are people, and just like anything else, some of them are kind of jerks.
Yeah, and I don't put up with that. If they don't listen to me, if that's this is the thing. If I see a doctor and the doctor is just blowing me off, not listening to me, telling me the symptoms I've experienced for years and have documentation of are not real, I find another doctor. Because that person is never going to help me, you know?
Yeah. So I called the insurance company back. Well, now I did call another doctor's office. And I asked them, you know, new patients. And they said, well, we can't see any new patients until the end of March. So end of March, middle to end of April, we're talking the same difference here.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of the two choices, I liked the one that I already had better.
Mm-hmm.
So
there you are.
I figured, okay, let's do that and just stick with that. So now I'm in this zone where I can't go to an ophthalmologist without authorization from my primary care doctor who I can't see for 13 weeks.
Right, because if you go without that, they're not going to cover any of it, and we can't afford to pay out of pocket for that. Yeah. That's why we have insurance. That's why we have poor people insurance, because we can't afford any of this.
If I go to the ophthalmologist on my own, then anything that they do...
You're going to be charged for out-of-pocket.
I've got to pay for, you know, myself.
Which is going to put it back on credit cards, which we just kind of tried to not...
We don't have any credit cards,
so that ain't it. But, I mean, then we're going to owe money we can't pay. You know, what would be the point of that?
So, I'm trying to kind of decide here, you know, do I call this call center back and tell them, well, you know, we can give it one more go around and see if maybe what happened last week was a fluke? Or do I just go, well, I'll call you back after I get to an ophthalmologist. It'll probably be the middle of the year. Because, you know, I won't get into my primary care doctor till April.
Mm-hmm.
End of April, pretty much.
And if they send you to a specialist, then you've got to wait for that.
You know, the ophthalmologist. One of the good things is the... insurance works with one really big ophthalmology practice out here. They got like 8 doctors. So the likelihood is that despite, you know, where I'm at being a new patient and apparently having lousy insurance, I probably won't have to wait, you know, 13 weeks to get into there. But, you know, it'll be the end of April, so figure it'll be at least a few weeks. And then whatever the results are of that, you know, if they decide, if the doctor does prescribe me glasses, it's going to take a little while to have those made. So, you know, I'm basically looking at the middle of the year before I'll be able to really try it out again in kind of full-on everything mode. So... I'm at this juncture where I'm kind of going, okay, I've worked for, in the course of my adult life, 3 of these companies. And if you mash all the time together, it comes out to roughly about, you know, 16 years cumulatively. And the first time that I got hired by this company was December of 94, so just a scant bit over 20 years ago. So what that means is I've done this work, for better or worse, depending on which day you talk to me, for, you know, more than anything else in my adult life. And until now, it's never been a problem that led to the kind of problem I faced last week.
With the eye strain.
So, suddenly I'm kind of faced with this situation of, well, can I not actually do this job anymore? I mean, in some ways it feels like that's probably true. And then that kind of tells me that there's probably a lot of other computer-based work that I can't do. And that's kind of like all I can do. I mean, the stuff that I do at home, you know, for myself is not a problem.
Well, you can blow up the screen as big as you want. You can take breaks whenever you want if you're doing it for yourself. I mean, because this isn't, you know, there's no deadline. It's as you can, you know.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. when I'm doing, you know, freelance work, you know, Jen mentioned a lot of good things there. But I mean, even in the interim now where I've been, you know, unemployed, I've still spent plenty of days where I was in front of the computer for, you know, 4 or 5 hours at a clip. And yeah, I would get the normal amount of eye strain. I'd walk away and do other things, you know, take a break, do whatever, come back later, and I'd be okay. And this was the exact opposite of that. So
yeah, it wasn't going away at all.
I'm kind of like, I think I sort of went through a phase similar to what happens to people when they sort of go from a state of, you know, quote unquote normalcy to being disabled. Like they have to go through that whole sort of acceptance phase of, I used to be able to do things like this and I can't anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I mean, I was born with this visual impairment. So, and from what I understand, I mean, the condition is genetic and it is degenerative by nature. And I've seen from certain things online and whatever that, you know, it hits people at different times in different ways. So in some ways, I'm kind of lucky in that I just came out of the chute at kind of a low level. Because there's people that start out higher and, you know, they may live well into their adulthood being able to do things like drive cars, you know, see relatively normally, you know, act, you know, just do things on a day-to-day basis that more normally sighted people do. And then one day they notice that their vision's not what it was before. They go to the eye doctor. The eye doctor says, this is what you have. And this is the nature of your vision, and we're not going to be able to correct it beyond this certain level. And then, you know, their whole world falls out from under them.
Mm-hmm.
So from a certain perspective, I mean, I don't have to necessarily deal with that, but I do have to deal with the nature of this kind of whole thing. And to try to explain it a little better, I mean, I know that, like, I looked up online, you know, what are some remedies or things you can do to try and alleviate eye strain. And a lot of them are great things to do if you are, you know, a more normally sighted person. They're not going to help me at all. Because the thing is that when I'm using this software with my computer, my 27-inch iMac, okay, this is nearly as big of a display as you can get. They're just because, and I have the zoom function turned on in OS 10. So not only do I have this large display and I have my resolution set relatively low, but I'm also zooming in on top of that. And I'm still sitting, you know, my face, like my nose is probably just a few inches away from the screen. And I'm still coming away with, you know, this massive eye strain. So clearly, it's not just a simple fix from that perspective. But the thing that's challenging is the software that I have to use. It's a singular window that's kind of broken down into four sections. So what happens is, in order to do everything, my eyes have to constantly jump from one section to the other. And that is where it's that constantly having to regain that focus, that's what causes my eyes to get tired. And there's no way to change that. There's not an alternative to the software. And I know that a lot of visually impaired people do call center-ish type jobs with screen readers. And that works if you're doing something that is repetitive in the sense that you're like doing order taking, doing reservations, where you're just dealing with the same information over and over and over again. And when you work at this kind of company, you've got hundreds, potentially thousands of different accounts that all have different information, different requirements. So trying to manage that through a screen reader would be incredibly slow, incredibly inefficient. And not only that, the screen reader would have to run on the, from my perspective, the remote computer. And the audio would have to then come through, you know, the internet connection, and it would be even worse. So, you know, the reason I'm saying all this is I know that people are probably hearing this and they're thinking that, oh, they, you know, you can try this. And believe me, I'll take any suggestions anybody has. But I have, you know, I have looked into this. I've looked into solutions, and so far I haven't really found anything. So
let me just clarify for people that don't know, you have optic atrophy.
Yeah.
And what this means is, essentially, in short, it doesn't matter what kind of glasses you give him or what kind of lenses you put in front of his eyes. The problem isn't with the eyes themselves. It's the nerve that connects the eyes to the brain and how it processes visual stimuli. So it's not a matter of just get better glasses, you know, in the most cases, it's not a matter of just blow up the screen. It's a matter of processing. And that's where some of the strain is coming from.
And it isn't like, you know, like, and I kind of made this analogy to Jen. I said, if it was something like I used to work a very physical job and I had muscles that had essentially atrophied and just needed to be built back up, that would be one thing, but this ain't that. You know, my eyes aren't going to get stronger by repeatedly straining them.
Well, that's true. Yeah. So. And it's not entirely your eyes is the other thing that a lot of people don't get, you know, and that's why they can't just fix it, because that's essentially brain surgery.
Yeah. I mean, and you can't you know, just put in, you know, I can't just put in eye drops or.
Right.
You know, get lenses,
there is no surgery
like
to give you different optic nerves. I mean, just no one can hook that up. You know, that's just not going to happen.
If there will ever be a genuine treatment for my condition, it's going to come probably through something like stem cells. And we're nowhere near that being a reality. So that's...
I think the only other option might be if, you know, someone works with those virtual reality things enough to, like, fix reality for you, like, make it bigger, you know?
Well...
But that's a long way away, too.
Yeah, you know? I mean, there are, you know, there are companies... There is a company that makes a particular type of, you know, visor, for lack of a better term, that incorporates bioptic glasses. But really, that setup would be good for someone maybe who was in a fixed situation and needed to see things that were far away. So maybe a situation where you were in a classroom and you were forced to sit in the back of the room, or for that matter, if you're sitting in the front of the room, to be honest, that was my experience, and you couldn't see whatever was being presented, you know, on a chalkboard or overhead projector or whatever, or for sort of spot checking things that are far away. So, for example, you'd have this, you'd be walking around with this headset, and you were out in public, and you were looking for a building, and you needed to see an address or a street sign or something that was far away that you couldn't really manage with the naked eye, or you couldn't get close enough to it, you could sort of flip this visor down and adjust it so that you could see whatever that thing was. But to use it as sort of a full-time replacement for your eyes, it wouldn't work because you're only seeing now in the far field. You know, it's not going to, you know, sort of replace your overall vision. You know, you'd have to imagine for something like that. I mean, thinking about, like, you know, I don't know, Geordie LaForge, right? I mean, it'd have to be...
That's a good analogy,
the way that they always sort of showed the way that Geordie, quote-unquote, sees in Star Trek would not even be...
He looked like he was seeing kind of like...
Thermal imaging,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sort of an amped up version of that,
right? Yeah, and which was not bad for the time that show was made, kind of thing. I mean, but it wouldn't work like real life
for something like that to happen. I mean, I don't know. I could imagine that there might come a day when, you know, some sort of implant could be devised that would either connect to or effectively bypass the optic nerve. And then you would have, you know, that's essentially what they did to Geordi.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would have, you know, some sort of apparatus that you would put on and, you know, that would effectively become your eyes. I could see that happening in the next 50 to 100 years. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. But, you know, it looks to me from everything that I've seen, if there ever will and truly be any kind of treatment for my condition, it's going to come from some sort of stem cell or genetic therapy or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're just at the very cusp of the beginnings of using that kind of stuff as an actual treatment. And, you know, it's probably going to be a long time before any of that happens. And certainly no matter what happens, it's not going to fix my situation today.
Right.
So
where are you at with the job then? Because I don't think that was completely clear.
Well, it wasn't, and I don't know. I mean, I figured, okay, you know, maybe it'd take me a month or so to get into an ophthalmologist. It's not a really long time. But now we're probably looking at, you know, 5-6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So I can try it one more time and again just see if maybe what happened last week was a fluke. Or I can just kind of go, I'll call you in June and you guys we can figure out if there's still any room for me over there and just see where things are at and try it again. I haven't entirely decided yet. And I think the thing that I'm struggling with above and beyond everything else is, I don't know, I wonder if in some regards that this isn't kind of a, you know, message from the universe to kind of say, you're done with that. Like, that's not a thing for you to do anymore. And it's time to do something else. And what exactly that something else is, I don't know. I mean, I've applied for, you know, many jobs, had a couple of interviews, but nothing's panned out. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, what do you think I should do? Do you
have
any
no
thoughts?
Idea. You can't keep doing that job if it's fucking up your eyes. I mean, you know, that eye strain,
no.
That's no one can do that.
No,
that's
I mean,
ridiculous.
I wouldn't, like, if Jen, I mean, as bad off as we are right now, if Jen went and, I don't know, maybe through whatever happened, you know, Jen took a part-time job somewhere, you know, I don't know, a daycare or a bookstore or something, and, you know, a week or two into it, she just came home every day, you know, completely sick from allergies, totally.
Which did happen both times. I've worked for both of those. It did happen, but I was younger then.
And, you know, I would never say to you, well, you know, suck it up, tough it out, we need the money.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just, I mean, that is like,
well, see, that's the thing, like, in the past, when I was younger, okay, I could essentially do that for a while. And by the time I was ready to leave the bookstore, I knew that I couldn't do it anymore. I'd gotten older. You know, I'd spent like 5 years, I think, working for the bookstores, you know, two different places, the same company. And maybe six, you know, something like that. And when I went in, I was able to do it just barely. The amount of dust, the amount of, you know, whatever they clean with, all the people coming through with perfume or anything else, cigarette smoke, you know, all of those allergens that plague me constantly, you know, in a place, in a work environment that I can't leave, you know what I mean? I could kind of do it for a while, but by the time I was coming out of there, you know, I was sick every day from allergies. I've had people that have seen me after I've left work that used to work there with me, and they noticed that I look a lot healthier now.
Yes.
Because my face isn't swollen, my eyes aren't swollen shut, you know, all of that. I can breathe better, they can hear me better because I can speak more, I'm not having as much trouble breathing, you know, that kind of thing. They noticed it visually. I mean, it was a big deal. And in addition to that, I've also had tendonitis on both arms twice in the course of working for a bookstore, because you lift a lot of stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, I got to the point where I'm like, I know I can't physically keep doing this. So I got a teaching job, which didn't pan out either. But exposed me to different allergens and germs, but wasn't as physical, I guess, kind of. So, you know, I've been through that. But, like, now I couldn't do the same thing I was doing then.
No.
Yeah. You know?
You know, the thing that is, I don't know, I mean, I don't want to say frustrating, it's not the right word, but like the situation for us right now is with, you know, the bankruptcy and everything behind us.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's behind us, it's closed, but the creditors still have 60 days from that point.
Yes, the 60-day thing is still in play, but
yeah.
I mean...
They have 60 days to come after you, essentially.
From our perspective, you know, I mean, if that happens, it happens. We don't have any control over that, but
yeah, well,
the
point is... I'm counting days. I'm literally counting days.
The point is that... just from, you know, looking at kind of our financial situation as it is right now, I mean, it's done. The debts are effectively discharged, all that. So we have just, like, when you put it down on paper, you know, we have almost just enough financial resources to just kind of squeak by. That's with the meager income we have and the food stamps that we get.
And your disability and the food stamps and, you know, the little bit you and I are making from the internet, so to speak. That's where we're at.
And, you know, it would be amazing to you know, like if everything had worked with this job. You know, I was figuring I'd get, you know, 20, 25 hours a week, which is all really I can hope to work. But financially, it would have stabilized things for us, you know, in a pretty nice way. We would not have been rich or wealthy, but it would have given us enough money every month that, you know, we'd be, for the most part, okay until, you know, the next thing dropped out.
Right.
And the good and the bad about that is that we don't necessarily have a huge hurdle to get over. It's just we don't have the same capacities to get over it that everyone else does. Yeah. And I'm really seeing the reality of, you know, the economy and the job market and everything right now, because I have been applying to, you know,
to like everywhere in town.
I mean,
really, everything that he thought he could do that had a hiring sign up.
You know,
I've applied on Craigslist.
You know, over the last, you know, year plus, you know, I've applied at Starbucks. I've applied at the dollar store. I mean, it isn't like I'm overshooting my mark and trying to land, you know, six-figure engineering jobs or whatever.
No,
like,
I'm just trying to find
a part-time job that'll give me enough money so, you know, we can get a little bit over, you know, a little bit over that hill financially. And it doesn't necessarily take a lot, but there's things, there are work environments that I've never been in. I've never worked in food service, and I don't know that it's smart.
I don't know that you should, considering your vision.
And because of, like, it's like a two-sided thing, okay? I probably actually can't run most commercial registers because the screens are going to be too small. They're going to be in places that are going to be hard for me to see.
Right.
And, you know, now, and while I worked once a very, very basic cash register where everything was manual. So it was just a matter of, you know, I would put in the prices of things and it was just, that was all that was on the display. It would show you the numbers as you entered them. And then it would, you know, have a, you know, you'd press in the cash amount and it would tell you the change amount and it would print out a very basic receipt. So that kind of thing I could handle. One of the reasons why I applied to the dollar store was everything's a dollar. There's never a question of how much did that ring up for?
You know? It should be the same all the time.
Mm-hmm. So that, because that's the thing that happens at stores all the time. It's a normal thing. But I would not have the capacity to turn around, look at the register screen,
and see what it
said, and go, oh, it was X amount. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. It's like, I'm kind of in this weird place now, and I just have to decide what to do next. And, last year we had formed, somewhat ill-advisedly, maybe, we had formed an LLC because we wanted to kind of create this sort of umbrella organization that would sort of take care of, would sort of become the hub for all of our freelance stuff. And I did that on, I don't want to say a bit of a whim, but I kind of did. And I sent the paper off to Secretary of State in Sacramento. And a couple weeks later, we were having our bankruptcy consultation. So
yeah.
I kind of said, and I didn't know for sure if the paperwork for the business would go through, and it did.
Right. But then the other thing was that $800 they wanted.
And the wonderful thing that happens when you form an LLC inside the state of California is there is a minimum $800 tax bill, essentially, to the California Franchise Tax Board that you can't get out of. You have to pay it.
Doesn't matter.
I mean, even if your business makes no money and you pay no taxes from actual business, mm-hmm. you still got to pay the $800.
Right, and we couldn't
now
because we don't have it.
Now it's there is a rule in that if you dissolve the LLC within the first year, you don't actually have to pay the $800, and I'm kind of sitting here going, is this the universe telling me go, 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 go now, do the business, put everything you can into it.
When's it due?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it would technically be due in April because we'd file it as part of our 2014 taxes. Mm. But if I've got a year before I can.
You might want to find that out,
Yeah.
Because we don't have it. We're not going to have it by April.
It's unlikely. So, I'm kind of like looking at all these things. And yeah, I mean, the practical and logical thing to do would be to dissolve that LLC.
I thought you did, honestly. I thought you did.
Well, I was looking into it and then, I don't know, I got busy with other things. Mm. But it's just a matter of, I have to fill out one form and mail it. It's not a huge.
And then how long does it
convoluted.
Take for them to process that?
Well, if I did it this month, I'm sure it would get done by the end of February.
Okay.
But the bottom line is we've got a year until, I would say until May.
Yeah, why don't we wait till we have some modicum of stability before we have something we know is going to charge us $800 right away?
Yeah. Well, that's again, that's a practical way to look at it. And ultimately that is probably what will happen. But I don't know. I don't know if there's anything else to say about the whole thing, but there you go. So on Friday, the good thing that happened is my eyes kind of came back to a normal state where I could actually use them. And then on Friday night, Jen went to take a shower.
Yeah.
And what happened?
We had no hot water at all, right? It was ice cold. Usually the hot water here is pretty good. We don't there's just two of us. I mean, how many showers can two people realistically take? It's not like there's a house full of people, all using the hot water all the time or something. So there was no hot water at all. And usually if you wait a minute, it'll heat up and okay, great. There you are. You're set. There was none. It was ice cold and it was just okay. There's no hot water. So I, didn't take a shower cause it was painfully cold. It was really, you couldn't psych yourself into, okay, I'm just going to do this. It was beyond that. And, so I'm like, well, great. I'm not taking a shower right now. And I, got dressed and, you know, told Sean, hey, we don't have any hot water. And at the time, I figured, okay, you know, I haven't really been paying, I've been sick, I have a sinus infection, so I haven't been really paying much attention to, like, the timing of everything going on. And I thought, well, maybe Sean just took a shower and used the hot water, and maybe it'll be fine, you know, by tomorrow or something, yeah. is my immediate thought. And, you know, I've been working a lot. That was the other thing that I'd been really busy on. One of the sites I write for had a gig with a time limit that was a lot of work. And so I just went at it and just did as much work as I could possibly do within that time frame. So I wasn't really paying attention to a lot of timing as far as, you know, maybe he just washed the dishes and used the hot water or something. You know, I just didn't. I figured, okay, that's possible. Maybe that's why there's no hot water right now, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and well, and generally speaking, you know, washing the dishes doesn't take away enough hot water to keep you from being able to take a shower.
Yeah, but I just figured, okay, maybe it's that.
It was a reasonable thing to look into, but no, that was not indeed the case. And, you know, we checked some of the other taps, and sure enough, none of them were getting hot water. So, you know, I really wasn't sure what to do. I mean, this was like 9, 10 o'clock
at night. Yeah, it was kind of late at night.
And our water heater
is outside, because that's how they do them with mobile homes out here.
Yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah, I mean, but ours is well and truly outside in a galvanized shed. So
yeah.
It was really too late for me to, you know, and I'm by no means am I an expert on water heaters. But I figured, well, there's really nothing, you know, we can do about it tonight. I looked it up a little bit online. I figured, okay, well, the pilot light went out. So tomorrow, after there's some daylight, I'll go out. I'll take a look at it, see if I can determine what's going on. So Saturday rolls around. And
there's still no hot water at all.
And I go out there and, you know, I open the shed. I pull the outer hatch off of the water heater. For the uninitiated here, usually at the bottom of a water heater, there's a little door that you remove, and from there you can see the pilot light and the burner. And sometimes there's another door in there, sometimes there isn't. Ours had a second one, and there was a little window in there, and I looked in there, and sure enough, the pilot light was off. So my first thought was, okay, well, I did some research on how to relight a pilot. I'll give it a try. And as I'm looking at the water heater, I can see this kind of, as you know, there's a part where I can see a vent in the side of the heater. And I can see this kind of shimmer effect across the vent. And I'm like, well, that's strange. Because the first thing I did was, when I went down there and I realized the pilot light was out, was I turned the gas valve off. And I didn't smell any gas, so there was definitely not a gas leak.
Right, and even if it was, I mean, it was outside, you know. It's not the same as having it in your house that.
I mean, if there was a gas leak, it wouldn't necessarily have been something we need to worry about from a health perspective, other than it's a gas leak. But there was definitely no gas leak.
Yeah.
That was not a problem. But I turned the gas valve off, because if you're going to relight the pilot light, you need to do that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I noticed the shimmering effect, and I'm like, well, that's strange. And I put my hand over, and I can actually feel that it's wet. And I thought, okay, well, that's a little strange. So I get up, and I'm kind of following, you know, like, because it's not unusual for a water heater to have a certain amount of condensation on it. But I was only feeling it really on that one side, not on the other side, not on the front. And I start to follow it up, and I realize that there's a certain amount of water that's essentially leaking out of the top of the water heater. Now, it's not a prodigious flood of water. You know, it's just a you know, it's essentially a steady trickle of water. And I start to kind of try to figure out, okay, well, what does that mean? Where's it coming from? I come back inside, I do some research, and it tells me that a lot of times what happens is, with the way water heaters work, there's an inlet and an outlet on the top. And usually what happens is, over time, the connections start to fail, and they either just become loose or they become corroded, and, you know, you may or may not need to replace things. And either way, you know, there's water coming out of this thing, and it's beyond, at this point, my ability to try to to fix it. I just can't see it well enough. So I called a friend of mine, the same friend who drove us to Santa Barbara and also rescued our tuna fish can.
Yeah, from behind the stove. Yeah, this guy knows everything.
I he's way more, you know, handy in general than I am.
I think he's probably seen a lot in his life. So like you tell him, this thing. And he's like, oh yeah, I know about that. Yeah. You know,
he really knows a lot. Yeah. I just said to him, you know, hey, can you come over and just take a look at this for me? You know, I need somebody with better eyeballs than mine to just kind of see what's going on. And he looked at it and he said, yeah, you know, he pretty much confirmed what I said. And he said, you know, this is kind of beyond me. I don't really want to do this kind of work.
Right, to fix it. Which is fair. Yeah.
So I figured, all right, I'll call the handyman who we had out to fix our sink earlier this year and see if he'll do it. So this was Saturday afternoon. I called him and left him a message. And we're recording on Monday night and I haven't heard back from him yet.
Right, so we don't know how long this is going to go.
I'm going to call him. If he hasn't called me, you know, by the time I'm kind of up and moving around tomorrow, I'm going to call him again. I'm going to leave another message and I'm going to say, you know, if I don't hear back from you by the end of today, I'm going to find somebody else.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You know, I would prefer if this guy can do it because he does good work, but also, you know, he's going to be less money than just calling a plumber.
Mm-hmm.
But at, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, we can't live without hot water forever. So,
right. Yeah.
You know, it's been obviously a frustration. It's been kind of a weird learning experience, at least for me.
Oh, I've lived with having no hot water before.
Because, you know, like I went to wash dishes and, you know, I was taking, I took a pot of water and boiled it on the stove, tossed it in the sink, and I wound up having to do that 3 times before I had enough. And, you know, I was mixing it with tap water,
mm-hmm.
and it took me several attempts before I finally had, you know, enough water in there to actually, you know, be able to wash the dishes. And then I had to do it again,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, well, this time what I'll do, it just because it would be faster and maybe easier, is I'll heat water up in the microwave. And really, that didn't work.
I took two.
I have one really large microwavable dish, and I filled it up twice, put it in the microwave for like, I don't know, 6 minutes each time. And the water came, you know, the water got relatively warm. I mean, I would hasten to say that it was borderline hot. And I tossed it in there and then again filled it in with some tap water, and it just got went from being cold to less cold. But mm-hmm. it was good enough that I could wash the dishes.
Yeah.
And then yesterday I took a sort of I wouldn't really call it a full shower because I couldn't be fully submerged in the cold water.
Yeah, like there is a difference, I think, between not having, you know, enough hot water and not having any.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was, you know, that was interesting. And I know you had a fun experience trying to wash your hair.
Yeah, I was just going to like take the shower anyway, and I just physically couldn't. I just couldn't, so I just sort of stuck my head in the shower and tried to mm-hmm. wash my hair. I got water everywhere, but it wasn't that bad of a flood. You know, so I'm glad I cut my hair, because it'd be a lot harder otherwise, but I'm just going to have to wash my hair in the kitchen sink.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I was trying to think of things I could do, you know, could I possibly make it so that you could, you know, have essentially kind of a warm bath. You know, just at least a not cold bath. And I think if I took both of my the largest pots that I have and just continuously tried to boil water on them, you know, you might eventually get enough water in the tub that it might, you know, barely
yeah,
almost
so
work.
We're talking like, you know, 1700s type of technology here.
I mean,
to try
it,
to,
it made yeah, me yeah, wonder because, you know, you see these images of, you know, people, and long before anybody would have probably had a gas water mm-hmm. heater, you know, taking these baths, And you always hear about how they would boil the water first, and I don't understand how they got enough water to actually do that.
I don't know that they must have had know if they were using as much water as we're thinking, you know. But
I don't know.
There were, like, depending on how far back you go, families would do this. The man of the house would get a bath first because he was out working in the fields on the farms or whatever, and then everyone else would use that same water after.
Yeah.
So that phrase, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that's because the baby would get the bath last and the bathwater would be dark by then.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know why you'd put a baby in that, but they did. And they had no other means, I suppose. But, you know, that's how they did. So that's kind of where we're at right now, you know. And it was just, I think the most frustrating thing about this is, like, okay, I've been poor my whole damn life. So I know how to deal with having no hot water. I've had it happen before, you know. It sucks. I'll handle it, you know. But I think the thing that's the most frustrating is I started off this year going, okay, so I got this extra gig with one of my regular gigs. So I know I'm going to get paid from this person and I know it's, you know, legit. And, you know, I'm like working my ass off trying to like do as much as I can for this extra gig under the time limit, thinking, great, we're going to start off this year with a little bit of extra money. We're going to be ahead. Now I'm hoping I made enough to pay for the new water heater that we're going to need, you know?
Yeah.
There it went. It's gone. I don't even have it yet. It's gone.
Well, we'll see what happens. I don't necessarily believe that we're automatically going to need a brand new water heater, but it may come to that. I mean, there's just no way to know yet.
Oh, it probably will.
So
that's how things go.
And I don't even know at this point. I mean, I should actually just call all the local hardware stores and go, okay, what would it cost for you to come out and just replace my water heater? And, you know, because a lot of times they'll have a deal where if you buy one from them, you know, for a small additional fee, they'll come out and install it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, depending on...
And then take the old one, so you don't have to worry about that.
Take the old one, yeah. And I don't know, in the long run, it may actually be a more equitable thing than trying to fix this one. But I know if I can get the handyman out here, that he'll come out here, he'll look at it for free, and, you know, he'll tell me, well, I can do it, and it's going to require these parts and it's probably going to cost us much money. Or he'll go, you know, this is either above my skill level or it looks to me like you should just get a new water heater. And then maybe he'll go, you know, you can get a new water heater and I'll put it in for you and I'll charge you this much. You just got to buy the water heater,
mm-hmm.
You know, whatever the case is. So, it sucks either way.
Pretty much.
And the other thing is, when we bought this place, we did a complete replumb of everything. So in, you know, less than a year, we had to have one faucet replaced, and now we're having this issue with the water heater. So that tells me that we can expect
more crap
more
to happen.
Of,
yeah.
You know, more
shit
more
falling apart.
More plumbing related things. And I mean, it's been almost 10 years. You know, we did that work in the fall of 2005, so we're coming up on 10 years, and, you know, nothing lasts forever. It's only logical that these things are going to give out, so. All right, well, one thing I wanted to talk about real quick. Well, before I move on to the next thing, I just want to remind everyone that we have a page at hypernosis.com/support, and you can send in a contribution through PayPal, Square Cash, or Bitcoin, and, you know, you can sign up for our Patreon there as well, and, you know, we would love that. Obviously, we can use the help, and I don't know how it goes with other pods. You know, there's these big-time pods that do a kind of crowdfunding and everything, and at a level, you know, those pods are obviously doing, you know, maybe great things, but a lot of that money, you know, goes to pay for the talent that's needed to keep that going. And in our case, I mean, it's kind of the same thing here, but I think it's on a much more basic level.
Yeah, that's like, probably true.
You know, mm-hmm. We're just trying to kind of stay living indoors and eating food and
having hot water.
Right. So I mentioned on the last show real quick that we had gotten an Apple TV for Christmas and we've been doing stuff with that. And a couple of things that I learned. Irk from the Channel Irk family of pods, he, you know, sent me a message on Twitter saying, hey, congratulations on the Apple TV. Check out the iTunes or the iOS remote. for Apple TV. So I did. I downloaded it, put it on my iPad, played around with it for a little while. And, you know, it's cool. I'm kind of okay with the remote that you get with Apple TV. I know a lot of people don't like it because it's small, but I'm really not minding it that much. You know, it's that typical Apple design where it's only got, you know, three buttons. It's got three buttons and a navigational pad. So not a lot of control options there, I guess, but it works. And another thing I discovered is if you have video files and you convert them to MP4, or if you just have them in MP4, and you put them on an iTunes library in your network, you can then stream those video files to Apple TV. So that was a nice discovery. I was trying to kind of figure out a way to do that, and there's this really popular home media server software called Plex. Well, there's no Plex app for Apple TV, which is really no surprise. You know, there may be someday in the future, but there isn't now. And there are these really kind of hacky solutions that you can throw together to try to get Plex on your Apple TV. And I kind of looked at all that and went, well, I'm not necessarily above any of that. I'll try it if I need to. But really all I want to do is just get these video files to play on the Apple TV. What are my other choices? And while it's kind of a lousy intermediary step to have to convert everything to MP4, because there's video formats that Apple will never support, you know, things like AVI, etc., which of course is everywhere. And actually we'll talk about that again here in a minute. But you know, it's working out. We're watching shows, having fun with TV. So we got a couple of comments to read over. Why don't you grab those?
All right. So one is from Matt, who says, every time you guys mention Santa Barbara, I'm reminded of one of my favorite shows, Psych. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it. We've got the Apple TV and Chromecast, but I hate that I can't play AVI files on it. These are arguably the top two streaming TV gizmos, but they don't support the most common video file? Lame. Anywho, let me come back on your show sometime. And that's from Matt.
And I did, you know, respond to Matt on the website, and I said the thing about, you know, if you convert to MP4, then you can throw those files into iTunes and stream them that way to Apple TV. As far as Chromecast goes, I don't really know. I was actually talking to our artist in residence, Blue Laugh, earlier, because he has a Chromecast, and I've never used a Chromecast, so I don't really understand how it works, but he was trying to kind of clue me in on it. Anyway, that solution to me with the MP4s is good enough for me for right now. I know that people who are like real, you know, home media nerds are hearing that and going, oh no, not MP4. Don't convert those precious AVIs to MP4. You're degrading your video. It looks fine for us.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I do not need Bar Rescue to be in, you know, I don't need it in glorious 1080p.
Mm-hmm.
It just needs to be good enough that you can watch it, and we've achieved that. So
yeah.
And the other comment you have.
Okay, the other comment is from Van Sunder, who says, "Congrats on the bankruptcy." I guess somehow that just doesn't sound right. However, congrats on getting rid of that anchor of debt.
We're congratulating ourselves with the orange of importance.
So something worked at least, yeah. Unless somebody comes after us in the next 60 days or less than 60 days. Moving on, Van Sunder continues, "We just passed through Santa Barbara a couple of days before you on the 27th. My observations on the town, in addition to yours about the money, is that the average height of the ladies seems to be 5'10". Tally was starting to feel vertically challenged by the time we left. I'm not sure what's in the water there, but my guess is that it's some kind of growth hormone." And that's from Van Sunder.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I noticed.
I didn't notice that either, but you know,
we just came out of bankruptcy court. I think we're just kind of dazed.
Well,
you know?
Yeah.
I don't think I was paying attention to much anything.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about that. You know, we were there, first of all, on a Monday, and we were not in a very, I mean, at first, certainly we were not in a very tourist-centric part of Santa Barbara, or sort of an area that I think attracts a lot of just sort of, you know, walking traffic or whatever. And then while, you know, we did go down to the pier for a little bit and we went to the mission, it was also kind of cold.
Yeah, it wasn't terrible, but it wasn't warm.
I'm thinking, you know, I know I know there are people who are probably hearing this in places where, you know, it really is genuinely cold, but
I mean, it wasn't like, you know, we're from the Midwest. It was fine, you know, but, you know, I think there's people that would want to spend more than, you know, we spent maybe an hour there. You know, I think there's people that would want to spend the whole day there. And I think maybe it might get a little cold after that, but I don't know.
Yeah. So, you know, we'll thank you for that, those comments. And of course, you can leave comments for this episode as well as any other by going to hibernosis.com, finding the episode of choice, and just typing it in right there. And we'll run down the rest of our contact methodologies here before the show ends. So I thought this would be worth going over just in case anybody who might be of a certain age bracket needs to feel old. We have 30 things that are turning 30 in 2015.
Oh, boy.
This is from Mental Floss. It says, while 1984 was iconic, 1985 was an even bigger year for pop culture. When we think of a song or a movie that exemplifies the 80s, it's very likely from 1985. If you made a mixtape of 80s songs, it would have a ton of stuff from 1985, Summer of 69, Voices Carry, Everybody Wants to Rule the World. Anything on Tom Waits' Rain Dogs, or how about Tom Petty's Don't Come Around Here No More? I would leave all the Tom Waits out forever. Without further ado, here are 30 things turning 30 in 2015. If you were born in 1985, you're in good company. Number one, the obvious one, Back to the Future.
Right.
The highest grossing film of 85 featured Michael J. Fox as a teenager traveling, wait for it, 30 years back in time. Now that it's 30 years later, the film holds up through doing the math, though doing the math makes us feel extremely old. Today's 1985 is as distant in the past as 1985's 1955.
Wow, that's weird to think about, you know?
Despite the feeling old issue, we're huge fans of Back to the Future, having briefly interviewed co-writer Bob Gale, dug up the blooper reel, made a quiz. It's also worth noting that Back to the Future 2 took place in 2015, so we can check in on how the movie future compares with reality.
And we've been seeing all these people putting, you know, pictures of
where's my hoverboard
and the picture of all the teens, you know, dressed kind of weird. You know, people have photos of that going, this is how we're supposed to be dressing now. This is what's supposed to be cool, you know.
It says here, bonus, Back to the Future included a cameo appearance by the great Huey Lewis, plus his new song, Power of Love, written for the film. It became the number one song on several Billboard charts in 85.
It's a good song.
New Coke, number two on this list. In the early 80s, Pepsi ran a killer marketing blitz, the Pepsi Challenge. It was a simple blind taste test of Pepsi versus Coke. Upstart Pepsi won more than half the time. While opinions differ as to why Pepsi won so often, the simplest explanation may be that it tasted sweeter. Good point there. Coke fired back by discontinuing its original formula and introducing New Coke, a smarter formulation. Everybody hated it, despite intense marketing. New Coke was such a flop that Old Coke was reintroduced 3 months later as Coca-Cola Classic. Eventually, New Coke turned into Coke 2. No kidding, that is true. And remaining store shelves until 2002. The one thing that I remember about that whole thing is...
About which thing?
Well, with the whole...
Pepsi Challenge thing?
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines just of New Coke and Coke Classic, and then later Coke 2.
Right.
I'm certain that Coke 2 sold in grocery stores for less money than regular Coke because my dad would buy it.
Oh.
I can remember.
Okay.
You know, I remember going through many distinct soda phases as a kid. And for a long time, you know, my dad only drank diet soda and that was all we had. Because my mom was never a big soda drinker. And then as me and my sister got older and we were kind of making demands of, you know, we'd like something in here besides whatever the diet soda is. You know, we would try to, you know, get Coke or Pepsi or whatever. And I remember many times having Coke 2 in the house. And I didn't hate it, but I knew that I liked classic Coke better. And it wasn't until probably much later in life that I really discovered that Pepsi was my overall preference for a cola. So, did you have anything to add?
No, I don't remember any of that. I remember the Pepsi Challenge. I remember taking the Pepsi Challenge in the mall a couple times. And at the time, I could tell you by taste.
I did.
Oh, yeah. They had it in the mall by me. And I remember doing it. They had a little booth set up just randomly in different places in the mall. One at either like end of the mall, I guess. And they'd have you do the Pepsi Challenge. And how it would work is they had sort of a board up so that you couldn't see what was behind it. And the person running it would, you know, have you sign up a paper or something and on a clipboard, that kind of thing. And then they'd, you know, set up, they'd pour whatever amount of soda into little tiny cups and they'd hand you one and not tell you what it is. So you'd get one, you'd taste it. They'd ask you, you know, what do you think of this? You'd tell them, they'd write it down and then they'd give you the next one and all of this. And I went with my friend and my friend took it. And then at the end they show you which one it was you picked. Right. And so then I did and I'm like, I can tell you what these are by taste. And they're like, oh no, you can't. That's no one can do that. I'm like, yeah, I can. And I did. And they didn't know what to say. Because now whatever one I said I'd pick was invalid because I already knew what they were. You know what I mean? But yeah. I told her, it's like, I can tell you by taste. Oh, no. Here, just take this. No one can tell by taste. Go ahead. No, I can, really. And I don't remember the Pepsi Challenge thing being in the mall for very long. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it was only there for like maybe 2 weeks or something. So I don't know if they just didn't get enough people or if it was just a very short run, you know, kind of promotional thing or something. I don't know. But I did take the Pepsi Challenge, and they actually had Pepsi and Coke and RC in our area. That's what they had.
Yeah.
So that's what it was. And, you know, it was no big deal. And, you know, it was a person with a clipboard standing next to a little booth that, you know, tried to pull you in much the way that these cell phone salesmen do now. But, you know, whatever. And they were asking teenagers mostly is where they were looking for. They weren't really looking for kids and they weren't looking for adults. They were looking for mostly teens. So that's who they got. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know why it didn't last very long there or what the deal was with that. I remember that. I don't remember Coke, too. I have absolutely no memory of that at all.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was, I don't remember how long Coke 2 stuck around. I don't think it was for a really long time.
I don't remember.
So anyway, number 3 on the list is We Are the World. Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie co-wrote We Are the World, and along with Harry Belafonte and Ken Cragen recruited a mega super group dubbed USA for Africa to record it. The purpose of the song was to raise money for famine relief in Africa, particularly Ethiopia, where a devastating famine was raging.
Mm-hmm.
The song was a massive hit, reaching quadruple platinum status, winning various Grammys, raising tens of millions of dollars for the relief effort.
Yeah.
The supergroup performing the song included luminaries like Bob Dylan, Ray Charles, Tina Turner, Willie Nelson, Paul Simon, Stevie Wonder, Dan Aykroyd, Bette Midler, the Pointer Sisters, the Jacksons, Smokey Robinson, Bruce Springsteen, Bob Geldof, Huey Lewis, you name it. Then it says,
I think Cyndi Lauper was in there too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bonus, there were also two major charity concerts in 1985, Live Aid, again focused on aid for famine in Ethiopia, with two concerts held, one in London, one in Philadelphia, and Farm Aid helping American farmers.
Mm-hmm.
Number 4, we'll just kind of mention this one, is WrestleMania 1.
Okay, I don't have really anything to say about it.
Number 5 is Pictionary. Apparently the game was designed and released by Seattle Games in 1985.
I didn't know that.
6 is Discovery of the RMS Titanic Wreck.
I do remember that.
On April 15, 1912, RMS Titanic struck an iceberg and sank. The wreck wouldn't be discovered until 85 when Dr. Bob Ballard and Jean-Louis Michel led a massive expedition employing a high-tech, remotely operated deep-sea vehicle named Argo. The key tactic that enabled the 1985 expedition to succeed when previous efforts failed was the use of cameras rather than sonar. By watching images, scientists were able to see the debris field from Titanic and eventually find the wreck.
Yeah, I do remember that. I remember that being on the news and everybody talking about that. Mm-hmm.
Apparently, in 1985, the song We Built This City was voted the worst song of all time.
Aww, but it was on the radio all the time.
So, you know, it's the...
I guess people got sick of it.
The writer says, I'm just going to come right out and say it. We Built This City has a great beat. It's easy to dance to. It's great workout music. This opinion may be colored by the fact that I only owned 3 tapes in 1985 and Starships... Knee Deep in the Hoopla was one. Uh-huh. The other two were Michael Jackson's Thriller and Weird Al's in 3D. Well, I had one of those.
Yeah, I didn't have any of those, but I mean,
I had one of those, and my sister had one. Neither one of us had the Starship record, so
yeah. Really? But that was on the radio all the time.
Oh yeah,
constantly. You'd hear that all the time.
Released in August '85, We Built the City was the kind of rock song that appealed to music lovers of the time, but almost immediately felt dated.
Yeah.
My personal opinion aside, We Built the City was voted the worst record ever in a poll of critics, lambasted by Blender editor Craig Marks for the sheer dumbness of lyrics.
Weren't very smart lyrics at all, but I don't think anyone cared at that moment.
A similar Rolling Stone poll reached the same conclusion in 2011. For the record, it was nominated for a Grammy in 86. let's see. This just says Guns N' Roses, DJ Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince, Indigo Girls, Jane's Addiction, Crowded House. A bunch of bands that would later become big deals, or at least moderate deals, formed in 1985. Probably the most notable is Guns N' Roses. Yes, that's the official capitalization and punctualization, which formed in L.A. when existing bands Hollywood Rose and L.A. Guns merged.
Mm-hmm.
After several major lineup changes, including the addition of Duff McKagan and Slash, the band was signed by Geffen in 86, released Appetite for Destruction. Today, the only remaining member from the original lineup is Axl Rose.
Right. Because for a while, the rest went with Slash and then went their separate ways, I think. They were Velvet Revolver for a little while,
Kind of what happened. The arc of that was when Axl kind of blew up the group. Slash and Matt Sorum and Duff McKagan went on to form Velvet Revolver.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
Slash is doing his own thing now.
Depending on, you know, if you're a true Guns N' Roses purist, then yes, the only remaining member is Axl Rose. If you're talking about who was in the band. If you want to put an asterisk on things, Dizzy Reed, the keyboard player, is still part of the band, but you know he was kind of he sort of showed up after you know during the Use Your Illusion thing.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit later.
It depends on if you want to go by who was on that first album or not. Yeah. But I mean, to me, I was a huge Guns N' Roses fan when they were like popular and all that. And to me, Guns N' Roses is Slash's guitar, you know?
Right.
That's to me what that is. So.
I will say this. At the time, I really was not a, you know, Appetite for Destruction and Lies really weren't that much on my radar. I like some of it, but it wasn't really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this thing that I like to say about a lot of bands where I'm kind of a wrong fan of that band. Like I don't do anything right because the stuff that I really like from Guns N' Roses is the stuff that most people say is the downfall of the band. I like November Rain.
Oh, I didn't think that was a bad
there's
thing.
There's a song.
You know? I think it's a pretty good
there's
song.
There's a song on the Use Your Illusion set called Estranged that is like my favorite thing they've ever done. And that's like the thing that people point to and go,
it was very different.
That was the immediate downfall of Guns N' Roses. And the other thing is, I really like Chinese Democracy. So
yeah, I think I got to give that like a fair listen. I don't feel like I've really listened to that much, you know?
Yeah.
This
is the thing about Chinese Democracy. If any other band had made that record and they had none of the baggage of Axl Rose and Guns N' Roses,
mm-hmm.
people would see it as a perfectly good hard rock album.
Mm, yeah. Well, if you take out, you know, all the drama of how many years it took to get produced and all that. I don't know.
So, number nine, Nintendo Entertainment System.
Yeah, NES. Played a lot of that.
Although NES had existed in Japan as the Famicom since mid-83, it became available in the U.S. in late 85, and even then it was only in New York City, the first of several test markets. The big innovations in the U.S. release were Rob, the robotic operating buddy, the Zapper light gun, and the release of Super Mario Brothers, mm-hmm. the game that made America fall in love with home video game consoles again.
Oh yeah, I played a lot of that. And later, with my brother, who had the thing memorized. It was amazing.
In later U.S. releases, the famous Super Mario Brothers / Duck Hunt split cartridge gave us a second fun game, although that laughing dog was kind of a jerk, which is true. Now, my story with the NES that I really remember is going into stores. I remember going into the Kmart in Crystal Lake, Illinois, and they had a demo version where it had the console and a couple controllers, and you could see the robot, and they had the light gun. I'm not sure if the light gun was demoable or not, but you could actually play some of the games. And I remember looking at it and thinking, wow, you know, that's pretty cool. I hadn't really seen anything like that. And for the summer of 87, for my 11th birthday, I did get a Nintendo Entertainment System, and I got the original full kit with the gun and the robot. And that original kit actually came with Gyromite and Duck Hunt. It did not come with Mario Brothers.
Oh, wow.
So I can say there are a few times in my life where I can say I was officially ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And if I had kept all of that, if I had kept everything and kept it in really good condition, it'd probably be worth a lot of money now. But I did hang on to the robot for a long time. I sold the NES in like 92 or 93.
Mm-hmm.
I took that money, turned around, and bought, I think, a Super Nintendo.
Well, that makes sense.
But
yeah.
But I sold the NES and I kept the robot for a long time. I did eventually sell it on eBay, I think. Unless it might still be out in the shed, but I think I sold it on eBay.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that I remember too about that in getting the NES for my birthday was we were gonna have a garage sale at our house, as we often usually did one in the summer. And my mom had asked my sister and I to go out to the garage and try to move some things around and get ready, you know, get some things ready. And we were moving these big piles of clothes around. And I can't... I'll have to ask my mom about this now, see if she even has any thoughts on it. But they had bought the NES. This was probably maybe, I don't know, a week and a half ahead of my birthday. They had bought the NES, and they had put it in the garage under some of these clothing piles.
Oh.
As a way to kind of keep it out of my sight, I guess.
Yeah, but then they told you to move stuff around.
But then they told me to go, you know, to us to go in there and move stuff around, and I found it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I found it. I was like, well, and I said, I know this. They're going to give this to me for my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want to go inside and say anything.
Right.
Because I felt like I wasn't supposed to know about it. And somehow I would, and somehow knowing it, you know, somehow if I said, why is there a Nintendo Entertainment System in the garage? You know, like if like somehow I would, you know, break some unwritten oath about birthdays and then I wouldn't actually get it.
Aww.
So I was just kind of like, well, I got it for my birthday. So
there you go.
I'll have to ask my mom about that sometime.
Mm-hmm.
So number 10 is Mask the movie, and Mask, M-A-S-K, the TV show.
I don't remember this.
Mask, well, I'll read it here. March 85, Mask hit theaters based on the true story of Rocky Dennis.
And Cher was in that movie. Yeah. I remember this now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Starring Cher, Sam Elliott, Eric Stoltz. The movie won an Oscar for Best Makeup. And then September 85, the cartoon Mask hit TV screens based on the overuse of backronyms. The title stood for Mobile Armored Strike Command. The good guys who are battling Venom, the vicious evil network of mayhem.
Oh, it's one of these. Okay. Nothing to do with the movie.
The cartoon was most notably for being a mashup of G.I. Joe and Transformers, leading to endless toy merchandising opportunities. I will say this. The Mask toys were fucking cool.
I don't remember that at all. I remember the movie. I saw the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
11 is the discovery of the hole in the ozone layer.
Wow.
So I think we can skip over that.
Yeah, 12, we know what that is, and right. It's still not fixed, and yeah.
Let's see. Okay. 12, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
That's been around for a while, yeah. Then.
13, Madonna's Big Year.
Mm-hmm. 85 was huge.
After releasing the album Like a Virgin in 1984, Madonna proceeded to blow up in 85. She starred in the movie Desperately Seeking Susan and appeared in Vision Quest, released the hits Crazy for You, Into the Groove, and Dress You Up, among others. Married Sean Penn and started her first North American tour with the Beastie Boys as opening act. I do want to say this. The thing that I remember, I mean, the most prominent memory that I have really about Madonna is, not surprisingly, my sister, who's 2 years older than me, you know, was a fan of Madonna and listened to her music constantly. And I heard it all, and I never minded it. I was just I didn't particularly choose to listen to it, but I didn't hate it. I was like, you know, if my sister was constantly, you know, playing the Madonna tape and the boombox this or whatever, I didn't come on and I would go, I can't stand this, I gotta leave the room. I was just like, I liked it, I guess. Yeah. But I will say this. I think that song Crazy for You is a fantastic song. It's a great pop song. I really like it.
Yeah.
Number 14.
I used to like Madonna a lot too. So I mean, I was listening to, like, when I was a high schooler, essentially, I was listening to Madonna, and I guess middle schooler too, depending on the timing. I'd have to figure that out. I was listening to Guns N' Roses.
You would have been in 85, you would have been 12.
Okay, so, oh God, I was in Catholic school that year too. So I was listening to Madonna, I was listening to Guns N' Roses, I was listening to, like, some of the Beatles stuff from my mom. I was very familiar with Black Sabbath from my uncles, and I had a mix going on at that point.
Yeah, the number 14 item on this list is Blockbuster Video.
Wow. Did those still exist anymore?
The first Blockbuster rental outlet opened in October 85 in Dallas. The brand rapidly expanded. As home video offerings changed, hello Netflix, cable kiosks, and on-demand, Blockbuster declined in 2010. It began the first of various bankruptcy filings. By January 2014, the last few hundred corporate-owned Blockbuster stores closed doors, though a few franchises are still open. Other notable businesses founded in 85, Boston Market, Tommy Hilfiger, Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville, and Enron.
Wow.
The thing that I think about, not so much about Blockbuster, because I don't think it was probably until maybe the mid-90s until there were any Blockbusters where I lived.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember, and it seems about right to me, probably that year, 85, 86, there was a small grocery store on the opposite end of town from where I lived, in the tiny town I lived in, that started renting videos. And it was one of those, like, things. It was like this weird thing where you went, you saw what it was. You were like, wait a minute, we're going to rent a movie and go home and watch it. Like, mm-hmm. this is a movie that you'd have to pay,
mm-hmm.
you know, you'd have to pay, you know, probably $25, $30 for to actually purchase the cassette. But you paid, you know, whatever it was, $2-3.
Mm-hmm.
And you were like, I can go home and I can watch this movie and it's all mine for one night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like this weird thing where you kind of realized, you know, everything just changed.
Yeah, I don't think I had that same experience, because my dad had friends that had, like, the first VCRs where they weighed a ton and it was like a pop-up kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So for years, for New Year's Eve, we were among a big group of people that they'd invite over to their house, or sometimes they rented out a few hotel rooms, and they'd just have movies running the whole time, you know? So, I mean, I remember, you know, there were, like, movie marathons on New Year's Eve for a couple of years, like 2 or 3, maybe 4 years. And, you know, I remember my dad had, like, a VCR and all that before you could rent stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So I didn't have the experience of, oh, wow, I can watch a movie at home. You know, my experience was, there's more. It's easier to access, you know?
Well, I think that, you know, my dad was always technology forward in a lot of ways. And, you know, we had one of those big clunky VCRs mm-hmm. when I was young, but mostly it was a way to tape shows and watch them later, which is what my dad did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the VHS market for movies didn't really start to mature until, you know, like 82, 83. And while, you know, we always had some movies, and by then my dad had gotten pretty good at, you know, taping them off of cable. But there was something different because, and the other thing too, that you don't really think about so much anymore, because the turnaround times on these things are so fast, but, you know, a movie would go to the theater and it might be, you know, 6 months, 8 months, a year, when it would turn up on VHS tapes. So the only way you could have it at that point was, you know, to go out and buy it and pay a bunch of money, or to rent it And I think that's why the rental thing seemed like such a big deal, because to own it was so much more expensive, and it would still be, you know, it would still be a huge chunk of time after that before it would wind up on any kind of cable TV.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that's if you had cable. Right. You know, if you didn't have cable, it didn't matter. But yeah. Mm-hmm.
15 is the first smoking ban in U.S. restaurants.
What? I don't understand.
The first smoking ban in U.S. restaurants?
Oh, ban. I heard man. Yeah. I'm like, I don't understand that one. They've been smoking in restaurants longer than that, you know. So the first smoking ban was 85?
Yeah.
Wow.
The first U.S. restaurant smoking ban went into effect in Aspen, Colorado, late 85.
And that's why I don't remember it.
Part of this progressive move can be attributed to then Surgeon General C. Everett Koop's campaign for a smoke-free America.
Right.
Similar bans.
Do you remember all those smoking stinks buttons people were wearing and stuff? I remember those.
Bans were enacted throughout the 80s and 90s, becoming commonplace today. Another historical tidbit, it wasn't until 2000 that the government banned smoking on domestic flights. Wow.
That sounds about right.
16, Calvin and Hobbes.
Oh, yeah.
17, Microsoft Windows 1.0.
Wow.
A year after Apple introduced Macintosh, Microsoft shipped Windows 1, a graphical user interface that ran various DOS applications in crappy Windows alongside a handful of actual Windows native applications like Microsoft Paint bundled with Windows 1.
I remember Microsoft Paint.
The writer says, I actually ran Windows 1 on my PC. It was painfully limited. On the bright side, it came with a game, Reversi.
Don't remember.
Steve Ballmer soon made a jokey promo video for Windows 1, which they've embedded here. Also in 85, Microsoft released its Excel spreadsheet package for the Mac.
That's weird.
Microsoft's multi-plan spreadsheet for PCs wasn't doing so well against competing spreadsheet software. Especially Excel took over Windows. 18, the first .com.
Really?
On March 15, 1985, the first .com domain name was registered. Symbolics.com was the new online home of Symbolics Inc., a computer company based in Massachusetts. By comparison, it took IBM more than a year to get around to registering IBM.com, but that was typical. Having an internet domain name in the mid-80s was not exactly mission critical. The .com top-level domain joined a handful of other TLDs, including .edu, .gov, .mil, .net, .org, and .arpa. Of course, in the years since, .com has pretty much dominated the domain name world. 19, these books came out. Contact, The Handmaid's Tale, and White Noise.
Wow.
I haven't read any of them.
I haven't either, actually.
they're doing sort of a combination here. 20, The Brat Pack, first seen in The Breakfast Club. We know what that is.
Mm-hmm.
21, peak levels of David Lee Roth in the Rockosphere.
Wow.
David Lee Roth left Van Halen on April Fool's Day, 85, at the peak of the band's popularity.
I remember the radio announcer saying it and everyone going, well, you're just pulling an April Fool's joke, right? And they're like, no, really? Nobody believed them until days later, you know?
The moment marked peak Roth, a cultural instant when David Lee Roth was as relevant and famous as he would ever be. He also released an EP of standards entitled Crazy from the Heat, including California Girls, complete with backing vocals by Beach Boy Carl Wilson, and a medley of Just a Gigolo / I Ain't Got Nobody, both of which were hits. These days, David Lee Roth is back with Van Halen.
Yeah, we saw him.
We did see them. A 22, the first commercial AIDS blood test.
Really?
In early 85, the U.S. FDA licensed the first commercial blood test to detect HIV antibodies in blood. Blood banks immediately began screening blood donations using the test at a cost of about $6 per test. That year also marked a series of major moments in the early story of AIDS. Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, debuted off-Broadway. Indiana teen Ryan White was barred from his middle school after contracting the disease from a blood transfusion.
Because he was a hemophiliac and he had a blood transfusion that had AIDS or had HIV and he caught it.
GLAAD was formed and Rock Hudson died age 59 from AIDS-related illness.
I remember that, too. Mm-hmm.
Bringing a very mainstream face to disease.
Yeah. And I remember at the time when Rock Hudson died, there were a lot of people that were like, wait a minute, he was gay?
Yeah.
There were people that had no idea, you know? And, I mean, now it seems weird to not have any idea that a celebrity, you know, celebrities, you know, who they date or whatever, I mean. But at the time, I mean, that wasn't something that was known. So that kind of... I think a lot of people really started paying attention then because they felt like it was someone they knew, you know?
Right.
And if it was someone they knew that they didn't think was gay, then you know, I think it kind of opened people's eyes a little bit. Like, it's not just, you know, one kid and you're hoping it's not your kid that's going to get, oh, he's got this weird disease. No one's going to catch that. My kid is not affected. I don't care. But, you know, if it was a movie star that you'd watched a lot of and knew and all of this and liked, I mean, I think a lot of people kind of went, well, this could be anybody, you know? Anyone could be affected by this. And that's why we had actual medically based, you know, scientific sex ed in the 80s.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, it was about, let's teach kids how to not catch AIDS. Mostly. I mean, it included like how to not get pregnant and, you know, all the different STDs that were known and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was primarily the sex ed was very accurate at that time because there was such a fear of people catching AIDS.
Mm-hmm. 23 is a list of actors and other people who were born in 85. We have Anna Kendrick, Michael Phelps, Raven Simone, Lily Allen, Reggie Bush, Colby Collette, Lana Del Rey, Zoe Hansen, Chris Humphries, Calvin Johnson, Carly Rae Jepsen, Keira Knightley, Emily Kimmy, Bruno Mars, Amanda Seyfried, Rooney Mara, Carey Mulligan, Jack Osborne, Allison Pill.
Oh, Jack Osborne. How about that? I know that one.
Cristiano Ronaldo and Raven Simone.
Yeah, I know a couple of those names, but Jack Osborne, yeah. I remember. It's like, Ozzy has a kid. Holy crap.
24 is Thundercats, Gem, and the Golden Girls.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Along with that, we also had, let's see, Amazing Stories, The Care Bears, Club MTV, EastEnders, G.I. Joe, Golden Girls, Growing Pains, Punky Brewster, Jem, Larry King Live, MacGyver, Moonlighting, Mr. Belvedere, National Geographic Explorer, She-Ra, Small Wonder, Star Wars Droids, Star Wars Ewoks, Twilight Zone, and Thundercats.
Do you remember Amazing Stories?
I do.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Yeah, it was just these short stories, and they were all kind of like sort of fairy tale-esque, and the Jim Henson production company was involved with the puppetry in that. And well, I mean, it was really neat. It told these little like fairy tales or parable kind of things. And it was a mix of puppets and actors relating to the puppets. And it was just really cool. I remember I thought it was the neatest thing ever because it was like, you know, here's an art form perfected by, you know, the Muppets and like Sesame Street, that kind of thing. Same group, you know, that could do all these other things with it as well, you know. And it was just, I remember it was really neat. Very well done. I'd like to see that again.
Number 25 is VH1, Nick at Night, Elmo, and the First Letterman Top 10 list.
Really? Wow.
26, this one's a little confusing. They've listed it as 26 Portlandia, parentheses, statue. In Portland, Oregon, the statue Portlandia was installed on October 6, 1985, after being floated up the Wilmette River on a barge, sculpted by Raymond Caskey, Portlandia is a 34-plus-foot copper statue of a woman holding a trident.
Okay.
Although it was obviously famous to Portland residents at the time, it became nationally notable when the TV show Portlandia borrowed its name and likeness.
Hmm.
Number 27 is The Well.
I need some context there.
The Whole Earth Electronic Link is one of the original online communities founded by Stuart Brand and Larry Brilliant. Wow, that's the guy's actual last name.
Wow.
It began as a BBS accessible via dial-up and evolved over the years as online services did. The Well set the template for how people could interact online. There's a good summary above, and here's a much longer panel discussion. I've embedded 28. Phil Collins, No Jacket Required. In 85, Phil Collins released his most successful solo album, No Jacket Required. It became a diamond record, more than 10 times platinum. Holy shit.
I didn't know that.
And won 3 Grammys, including Album of Year. He performed tracks from the album at Live Aid. Yeah, I did own that. And it's got just about every recognizable Phil Collins hit song that you remember from the 80s is on there. Number 29, the first million-selling CD.
Which
compact discs
it?
Became available in the early 80s, but it took until 85 for them to go mainstream. Dire Straits' Brothers in Arms sold 1 million copies.
Wow.
And I had that, but I had it on cassette. It took me... I did not have a CD player till about 94.
Yeah, I can't remember when I had one. It might have been...
I held out against CDs.
I didn't have it in college.
I was firmly...
Maybe later in college.
I was firmly entrenched in cassettes, wasn't going to give them up, and I had gotten into vinyl in high school only because I could get used records cheaper than tapes.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing on this list is 30, Studio Ghibli.
Oh, I didn't know that either.
Founded in June 85 by directors Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, and producer Toshio Suzuki, it has created animated classic movies including Spirited Away, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service, Castle in the Sky, Princess Mononoke, Howl's Moving Castle, Ponyo, and lots more. If you haven't seen a Studio Ghibli film, you're missing out. And there you go. That's the end of the list.
That's it. Wow. All in 1985. And I was miserable that year in Catholic school. I remember that.
I think I was certainly not in Catholic school because I never was.
Yeah, I was only in it for that year, and that was the end of that. I don't think I was really welcomed there very much.
I mostly have favorable memories of 85, whatever I can really string together there. I mean, I would have turned 9 in 85, so I don't remember this being a particularly memorable year for anything specifically in my life.
You were 9.
But I don't remember it as really being anything bad either, so.
Yeah. I don't know. It wasn't a great year. I mean, I was in a Catholic school.
Well,
I already knew I was an atheist. I just hadn't said anything yet. I was in a Catholic school. I'm like, well,
right.
Okay.
And it wasn't as though you had gone to Catholic school your whole life.
No, I had gone to the public schools my whole life. And I remember that in middle school, I was getting beat up by kids that we had a 6th through 8th grade school, and I was getting beat up by kids that were in 8th grade, and they would run before I could do anything, you know? And I remember, like, trying to get teachers involved and principals involved, saying, look, this is what's happening. This happens every day. It's the same kid. And they kind of blew me off, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of got to the point where I'm like, look, either I'm going to go ballistic one of these days, or I need to get out of here. And so my parents put me in a Catholic school because they're Catholic. I don't know why they picked this particular school. I don't know. I really don't know what happened with that. But it was less than ideal. The things they were teaching in that school were a few years behind from where I was when I left the public schools. I was in all the high-level classes when I left.
And you don't just mean it, well, there's that, but you don't just mean in, like, you know, science or whatever.
No, we had a good science teacher. That was surprising. We had a good science teacher. But, I was in the high-level classes when I left the public school. When I came into the Catholic school, they were a few years behind where I'd stopped, you know? So when I went back to the public school, I was now not in the high level classes anymore because I'd missed a year, you know, because I was in the Catholic school. But part of the problem was they didn't really like that I came from the town I came from because it was it's where the poor people lived. Okay. And they didn't like that my family went to a different Catholic church instead of theirs. So they didn't like that either. And there was a real stigma for not coming from, or for coming from the town that I came from. So it was really hard to make friends. Everybody that was in, you know, there were 13 kids in the entire 7th grade, you know, and that was it. And they'd all known each other since day one from kindergarten and all lived in a town far enough away where there was no way I was going to make friends with these people. Plus, they didn't want to make friends with me because I was from the poor area, you know, so that was kind of a problem. We had a teacher that, perpetually picked on a kid that had special needs because she didn't want him in her classroom. And I remember causing problems confronting her with that. And they don't like when you confront things in at least the Catholic school I was in. You know, critical thinking, oh my God, no, just do whatever they say. And I just couldn't do it because, I mean, my brother has special needs. He has autism. And I was watching this teacher pick on this other kid and just went off on her, you know. And I mean, I had her, by the time I was done, she was crying in her classroom and we were told to wait in the hall. So I did pretty good as far as that. But I remember things like in Illinois freezing on the recess field and kids going, oh, I wish I had my gloves. And I'm going, where are your gloves? What happened to your gloves? Thinking like they'd worn them out and didn't get a new pair or something, because that was my world, right?
Yeah.
Their gloves are in their locker. They just weren't allowed to go back in and get them. I'm like, I'll go get them. Nothing was locked. You know, it didn't matter. I didn't need another combination. I would go get it. Like, screw that. What are you going to do? Yell at me for, you know, making sure people don't freeze? What would Jesus do? You know, they didn't like me very well, so I was constantly in trouble. And I remember just some things were really uncomfortable. As, you know, like I said, the science class was good. We had a really good science teacher. I remember her explaining the Big Bang and finishing off the lecture with, and some people think that God did that, and moving on from there, you know what I mean? And so that was fine. That's all she did. It was fine, you know? But, I mean, I remember big chunks of class being taken up just studying, you know, things about Catholicism and different, like, you know, different ceremonies and rituals and all of that. And it felt weird to be doing that in school from my perspective.
The Da Vinci Code, you had a whole semester on the Da Vinci Code.
And we had a situation where there was some kids in the school that were in sixth grade at the time, and they were twins, and one was healthy and the other one was, by the time I got there, in like, he had some kind of cancer and it was progressing pretty bad. Like, you could tell, you know, he was barely ever in the school. When he was there, he was with a nurse and with an IV and wheelchair, and like, it, things did not look good, you know? And I remember that they took a big chunk of class one day and had us all in the chapel saying the rosary so that if we prayed enough, this kid would survive. And I thought that was just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, seriously, like, it wasn't like, I could understand if it was being done, like, because this was a tight community, a small group of people, if they were all, like, grieving and upset, if this was supposed to make them feel better, you know?
Yeah.
And to, like, tighten the community, but it wasn't. I mean, we were told if we prayed enough that he would survive, you know? And he didn't survive because he couldn't have, and because prayer does not directly make cancer go away. And I mean, I knew that as a 12-year-old. I couldn't imagine what on earth these people were thinking. And I didn't really know how to do the rosary their way. Apparently, there's more than one way. Okay.
Oh,
I didn't know, you know, and I couldn't figure out like where the last kid left off and which, how many I'm supposed to do. And, you know, I mean, I once they pointed it out, I'm like, okay, this prayer, that prayer, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I got it. But he didn't survive. So I had kids telling me that the reason he didn't survive was because I didn't do the rosary right. And I kind of went, you know, I'm not really supposed to be here at all. And they did start asking me questions about where I lived and why I wasn't in my other school. And you know, the reason I was not in my other school is because I kept getting in fights. And that scared the hell out of some people. You know, I mean, it was not a good place. So that was me in 1985, just freaking miserable, you know.
They said, we need to cast out this heathen.
Well, I know the principal, sometimes you will have priests as the principal. We did not have that in this school. It was just some woman who was a principal, who was Catholic. I don't know if she was part of that church or had just become part of that church or was new or whatever, but she was not thrilled with me. She was not thrilled with me. I mean, I'm certain I got talked about a lot because I would question things, you know? I wasn't just going to blindly go along with it. It's like, you know, you're out here in the recess field, your gloves are inside, you're going to get frostbite. This is dumb. I'm going to go get your gloves. They can yell at me. I don't care, you know? So this was me at 12. Anyway, I guess some things never change, you know, but that's where I was. And the year after, I went back to the public school. By that point, whatever eighth graders were there would have moved on to the high school and forgotten about me, I'm sure, you know. And so it was just a rough group, you know, it's a rough group of kids. They would do this to a lot of people. I don't know, man, I don't know why they picked me. But after a while, you get tired of being slammed into lockers and shit and having them run. Like, if they would stand there, this would have been solved, but they'd run. So by the time I got back, I, you know, had a whole year with people making friends in the middle school that I was not there for, you know? So it's hard to jump back in when everybody's got a click, you know, at that age.
Right.
You know, so that didn't work out. I was behind academically because the school that I had gone to was behind academically from where I'd left off. So now I was like behind, I wasn't in the higher level classes anymore. I was in some of the not quite as high level classes and some of the like basic classes, you know? And it just kind of like really screwed things up in a lot of ways. I never got back to the high level classes after that point. I had like a couple of situations where I could take a class and I had to have a teacher like, okay, it, you know, it was a higher class.
So like,
but, yeah, it screwed me up academically from that point on.
So like so many things in life, we can just say, blame the Pope.
Well, it was a different Pope then. it very much was a different Pope. But yeah, it was, since we were talking about 1985, that's where it was.
Okay. Well, anything else you want to add to this program?
Oh, no. I think that's enough.
All right, then. Thank you for listening. This has been Hyper Nonsense. We are a production of Hyper Nonsense Incorporated Industrials.
Sure. I'm trying to figure out what Hyper Nonsense Industrials would be exactly. Is this a clown college? I mean, what is it? What does it make? Or maybe the industrial refers to the, you know, constant construction going on around us in this mobile home park, you know? Anyway.
Hypernonsense Industrials, founded on the banks of the Fox River in Elgin, Illinois in 1948.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you so much for listening. You can go to hypernonsense.com. That's our web, and all our things are there. You can leave comments for the various shows. You can email us, show@hypernonsense.com. We'd love for an iTunes review. You can go to hypernonsense.com/iTunes. It'll take you straight to our listing in the iTunes store. If you're listening through an iThing, then you can actually just go into the app, the podcast app, and you can leave a review right from in there. It's so easy. It's Apple. It just works. Trust me, if you've listened to this show, you know how much Apple stuff always works. It's never a problem.
Mm-hmm.
We never complain about it. You can follow us on Twitter @HyperNonsense. We'd love to see some more signups over at our Google Plus community. If you go to hypernonsense.com/contact, you can get a link to that. I think if you go to Google Plus and you search for HyperNonsense, the community will come up. We have a Google Plus page, but we don't really care about it. We just have to have it in order to have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
But if you follow us there, you will see when new shows go up. So if you mm-hmm. like the Google Plus, if that's your favorite absolute place to hang out on the nets, you can go do that too. And, you know, I post things in there over mm-hmm. at the Google Plus community. Most recently, the world's first ever porn video shot with a drone.
Yeah, that's up there.
So
mm-hmm. had to happen eventually, so there it is.
You don't want to miss out on that. And other fun oddities as they show up.
Right.
So thanks, everybody, for listening. With any luck, we'll be back with you next week-ish or so.
Bye, people.